Yeah, what's madam cooks insta quachstut when you do trap a new stand I'm up off New Hulk Radio here in our beautiful sovereign New Hulk territory, and I have on the line with us for a quick little chat Dayaki Alfred. Why?
Yowts, Diego's gonna go.
Yowts, madam, yow Dayaki, great to have you here on New Hulk Radio. I just want to start off by saying that it's such an honor and a privilege to be able to share this time with you here today.
Well, Nyawa, thank you for that. It's an honor and privilege for me, too. It's to be able to be on New Hulk Radio is like a real pleasure for me because it's one of my favorite places on the planet. So thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I've shared a little bit of a bio about who you are, but I'd like to ask you to share with us from you who it is you are, where you're from, and what it is you do.
All right, well. My name is Dayaki Alfred, and I'm a Mohawk from Ganawage, which is outside of Montreal. And I'm a father, a hunter, and a writer, and someone who helps First Nations strategize about Indigenous nationhood and basically restoring the power of our nations and getting our land back. And I've been doing that for more than 30 years now, all over North America and the world. And for a long time, I was a professor first at Concordia University, Montreal, and then in British Columbia, University of Victoria. And last year, I left that and started working directly with communities and looking at finding ways to breathe life into the sovereignty and nationhood of our people. And I do that from where I reside, where my sons live. Two of my sons live here in the territory of the Saanich people, Victoria, B.C. And I go between Saanich territory and Ganawage or Mohawk territory where I come from.
Wow, beautiful. I look forward to some of the things we'll end up talking about today. But the main focus that we're starting with here is this audiobook that's being released, Whose Land Is It Anyway? A Manual for Decolonization. Can you share with us a little bit about this project and how it is you are involved?
Yeah, it's something that I'm greatly honored to be involved in because it came about as a memorial or an honoring of the work of Art Manuel. And, Art Manuel, a longtime leader in British Columbia, passed away a couple of years ago. And following in the tradition, in his family tradition, from his father, George Manuel, who was instrumental in leading many of the movements that led to the rise of Indigenous nationhood here in British Columbia, and which continues on through his daughters, who are making a stand in their own territory as we speak today, who are fighting back against colonialism. And so to be asked to participate in a project that really focused on the key messages that Art brought forward in his life and his activism was something that I jumped at in terms of the chance to be able to make a contribution. And so it was a project that was put together by the group that's the Union of Post-Secondary Educators in the province of British Columbia. And they assembled a group of people who are writers and activists and people who had been outspoken on the issue of nationhood and Indigenous rights and the assertion of that over years, and asked a bunch of us to put together short contributions that spoke directly to the people. So not academic and not too political in the wording and the way that they were written, but something that would speak to people in the communities in a very direct way about the things that need to be said about where we're at in this long struggle to get out from under the burden of colonialism and to bring to life for future generations our nations and our cultures and really take back what's ours in our own communities and in our own homeland. And the essay that I contributed was the focus on the land as the struggle.
So who might you say that this book would be for, and who might you expect to read or listen to this book?
Well, the nature of the project was for people who work in post-secondary institutions, so all the way from community colleges to universities, for educators at that level to have a resource to be able to speak about these issues in a way that was consistent with the principles of Indigenous nationhood. So that's obviously an audience there. But as I wrote mine and as I've read, I know this is true too, because as I've read the others, the audience is also First Nations people who might be listening, First Nations people who are putting their effort and their energy into activism to try to get people to focus on what the core goals are, what the principles are, because it's so easy to get distracted by different agendas. It's so easy to get distracted by false prophets. It's so easy to get distracted by high theory in terms of what we should be doing. And every once in a while, and I think this book serves this purpose, every once in a while, it's good to be reminded about what it's all about in a very basic way, in a way that comes from the heart. And so all these people that have written, they're all political actors. Some of us are or were scholars and academics, but they're all written in a way that speaks directly to the heart of the matter. And whether you're a non-native educator looking to bring some truth to this era of lies that we live in with reconciliation and indigenous rights and Aboriginal rights and title getting all clouded by all kinds of confusing lies that are put out there by the government, or whether you're a young native person who's just looking for guidance about where to channel their energies, this book and the voices in it are a really good place to start.
Wow. So how was it to collaborate with such a diverse group of amazing minds?
Well, the collaboration came only in the form of the assemblage of the book. The real collaboration came, the actual collaboration came with the people who produced the book. So the people who came up with the idea, the technical people, the editors and so forth. I don't know how it was for others. The real collaboration was kind of like that group with each of us. There wasn't an instance where we all sat down and worked together to produce the book, although it came out beautifully. And I think that a lot of the images and the structure of the book really reflect a true intellectual collaboration, which I think is a good sign because it shows that people are dedicating themselves to the principles of Indigenous resurgence and to Indigenous Nation and so forth, have a common mind and a common approach in a lot of ways that makes it easy to put together a book that seems seamless, even though we never actually all sat in the same room or even had a conference call.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Kind of an indication in a way of how grassroots it is as you all bring forward such important information and details from your lives and struggles and perceptions around the planet.
Yeah, and I think another aspect of that is that a lot of the people involved have a long history of activism. And so, you know, there's a kind of a memory of the people and the events and the kind of vocabulary and the terminology gets shared because we've all been in it for so long and we all kind of have reference points that are common in the struggles that we've been in. And so when we're asked to talk about something, the framework of our message is basically set already. So that's another reason I think it was easier to collaborate in an intellectual sense on this. There was no real, in my mind anyway, I don't think there was any to deal with. There was no contradictions or sort of messages that were against each other or didn't agree too much. You know, everything flowed and was consistent. It was all different, like facets of the same stone.
I would recommend to anyone out there to read the entire book, but if one was to read just one chapter, is there one that you might suggest?
Well, it's hard to pick one out. they're all good. And see, I don't want to name someone else and pick them out, but let's start with mine.
Right on. Well, what is your chapter about? You mentioned it's all about the land. Can you explain a little bit about your essay?
Yeah. The spirit I brought to that was out of a little bit of a sense of frustration a few years ago that started to bug me about how a lot of the politics in our communities were getting clouded. You know, there's a lot of energy and thought that goes into what's called identity politics, which is kind of an individual empowerment, which is great. It needs to happen, and people need to kind of work through the issues of identity, whether it's, you know, their own personal identity in relation to their nation or whether it's on the basis of gender and so forth. But in my mind, it can't be forgotten that the real purpose of getting involved in Indigenous politics is to restore the presence of our law and our governance on our own territory. And to me, I felt whether it was right or wrong is debatable, but I felt that it was getting clouded, like that message was getting clouded and people were getting distracted and putting their energies in ways which were actually undermining the struggle of our people in the most fundamental sense, was challenging the supremacy of Canadian law and challenging the idea that Canada has title to our land, and much more so activism around that. So people really channeling their work into restoring the institutions that used to govern our people before colonialism, the matriarchies that used to govern our territories, the systems of government and law, which were our own, how we're present, our use and occupation of our land, our ability to defend it. All of these things are core to what it is to be a nation and the exercise of our sovereign power. And that was getting distracted from by other types of politics. And again, I want to emphasize that other types of struggles are real and need to be fought. But at the same time, we cannot forget that all of these things that led to the destruction of our nation that are still there pressing on us, if we're not careful, and if we don't devote as much time to defending land and restoring our traditional governments as we do other aspects of our struggle, the Canadian government's going to accomplish the objective of taking everything from us and totally imposing their own law on us. And a generation from now, we won't have anything left to stand on as far as our own governance. Even our own presence in our own territories is very tenuous at this point because of the fact that we haven't been as assertive as we need to be over the last generation of activism. So that was the spirit I brought to mind, and it was really almost my essay. I wrote it almost like a speech I was going to give to try to motivate people to remember that spirit that our ancestors brought to the struggle, which is, it isn't about me. It's not even about anything but the land and the protection of it and our respectful relationship and carrying out our responsibilities according to our teachings to the other nations that inhabit it. And by those other nations, I mean the animals, the plants, the water, and all that. And so many generations of our ancestors fought and died and struggled to keep that alive. And I just think it's a big tragedy for a generation or two of our people to get distracted and to imagine that life as an Indigenous person could be lived within Canada and not within the context of our own nations, and to remind people that that's a lie. Anybody who says that you can live as an Indigenous person, as a Canadian citizen, and draw on your identity from Canadian ideals and Canadian law is telling you a lie, and their intention is to destroy our nations. And to bring that spirit forward again is something that we really need, because it's the spirit of our ancestral resistance. And that's what I hope to touch on in the words that I offered in that essay.
Mm-hmm. Wow. One of your phrases that you use in your section of the book is ancestral memory. And I have here a clip to share, and I'd like to ask you a little bit more about it.
A constant surge of ancestral memory running through our veins has empowered and enlivened us and given us the gifts of tenacity, anger, patience, and love, so that the people may continue, and so that the generations that are yet to rise from the earth may know themselves as the real people of the land.
Why? So what is it you mean by ancestral memory?
Yeah, that phrase there, For a while, and I think there's still people who kind of advocate the idea that it's wrong to be angry, that, you know, anger doesn't get us anywhere. But if you look back on history, even if you reflect on what's happening now in the world, in the United States, and in regard to the black people standing up for themselves against centuries of oppression, and the racism that's woven into the fabric of American society, it's quite obvious that you don't get anywhere in terms of making change in the society that you live in if you don't bring the fire that anger produces. You have to fight back. And we've been told, especially in the last 10, 15, 20 years by our intellectual leaders and political leaders too much, that we should be patient, that should we work within the system, that should we should trust white people, that we should bring this approach which is collaborative and blah, blah, blah. Where has that gotten us? Our ancestors weren't that way. Our ancestors brought fire. They brought passion. They brought anger. They brought that spirit of resistance, which allowed them to survive in the face of incredible oppression and anger and violence and racism towards them. And I just think it was completely deluded for people in our community to think that we could survive without maintaining that fire. If we don't keep that fire burning, which is a righteous indignation and a righteous anger at the crimes that have been committed against us and the land, we don't stand a chance. So ancestral memory is the memory of the way our ancestors were and fought back, and not being convinced that our ancestors were somehow wrong or somehow misguided to fight in the way that they did, to fight hard, to fight even using violence sometimes to resist the oppression and the violence that was brought against them. Ancestral memory is how to survive, and there's a lot of people that are trying to tell us that we shouldn't be that way anymore. Of course the Canadian government wants us to be passive, because that's the way they've always stolen our land. That's the way they've imposed everything on us. The people that survive in this world who are oppressed are not the ones who passively accept what's being done to them. They're people who stand up and draw on the righteous anger of the crimes that were against the crimes that were committed against them in order to shape their resistance going forward. And you see that happening right now in the United States, and you see the changes that are happening because of it. All of these things didn't happen because people wrote petitions or people complained. They got out in the streets, they're fighting back. And I think that if you look at our own history as Indigenous people, every major advance has been because people have disrupted, confronted, and fought back when it was necessary in order to survive. And so to me, when I think about ancestral memory, of course we have all kinds of things that we have in our past that are to be celebrated, but to take out the fire of resistance and put that aside and say everything else is okay, everything else is good, everything else is worth celebrating except fighting back, don't do that. To me, that seems like someone who's trying to cause us to lose the fight, not someone who cares about us.
Wow. And in your essay, you mentioned that trespassing on our own homelands. Now, it's been shared with me that as a Nuchalk person, I should never fear to step anywhere in our lands. What are your thoughts on so-called private property and ultimately the criminalization of Indigenous peoples in our own homelands?
Oh, well, that's been it from the beginning, eh? You know, our idea of what our territory is and what our homeland is and our rights within it come from our ideas about the relationship we have to the land, both as nations and then just in general, the way humans relate to the land. And the whole idea of private property and mapping and boundaries that was brought from Europe is the crux of the whole problem. It's how we relate to the land. And right from the beginning, people have come and tried to put the idea of private property at the center of the whole way of life here. And we've been resisting that. You could trace the history of every First Nation, and it's always a struggle between the idea of collective ownership on one hand, collective common use on one hand, and on the other hand, the respect for the territory of our nation rooted in thousands of years of history. So it's both territorial and it's also a qualitative thing in terms of the way the land is used. And when white people first came here, they attack both of those. That's why I say it's always about the land, because it's still the same. I've been in your territory. I've been a lot of places in First Nations territories, not only in Canada, but all over the world. And the idea of a Native person living out her culture in her own homeland is probably the most radical thing that you can do, which is why governments try to control it and criminalize it, and why settlers who understand the power of a connection of a Native person to her homeland, they understand that power, which is why they try to defeat it and minimize it and convince us that it's impossible. And when all else fails, when we still act on it, when we still go onto our land and be indigenous on our own land, then they use violence as their last resort. They try to get us to believe it's not possible. They try to make laws which make it criminal. We don't care. We still go and do it. Some of us in every community. Then what do? They bring their violence. So to me, that's where everything boils down to. You know, everything boils down to a person living out their culture, their spirituality in the land and in the place that their ancestors gave them as their birthright. And if you can't do that, you need to resist, you need to push back, you need to fight.
Beautiful. And in your essay, you state a resurgence of authentic land-based indigeneity. And I have here a clip to share with our listeners, and then I'll get some feedback from you.
There really is no way to decolonize from within the reconciliation paradigm. There is no way except to get out. A resurgence of authentic land-based indigeneity. Our youth must be shown that they have the power to resolve the basic anxieties and psychological discords afflicting them by recognizing and respecting the powerful gifts that are there in their ancestral memory. The way to fight colonization is by reculturing yourself and recentering yourself in your homeland.
So for our youth that might be listening out there and might be unsure of what can be done, what sort of message might you send to them?
The first message I'd say is that you can be both a Canadian and a Ungwehungwe. In our language, that's a Native person. We're surrounded by, oppressed by, forced into the mechanisms of having citizenship pressed down on us of a Canadian. That's a reality. I'm not denying the fact that there's a reality that out there that's forced into our communities and into our lives. But it's a very recent thing where Native people have accepted the fact that they're anything but Nuhalk or Ganyakahaga or Saanich or anything like that. It's very recent. And look where it's led us. The young people need to understand that our ancestors were Nuhalk and Mohawk. They weren't Canadian / Nuhalk. They weren't Aboriginal Canadians. They weren't Indigenous peoples within Canada. If our people are going to survive, and if this next generation and the ones that come after it are going to be leaders into the future as Indigenous people, they're going to have to understand that they have to break out of that mentality. Anyone who tells us that we can merge the existence of our nations, our governance, our law into that of Canada is lying for the purpose of advancing the agenda of Canada. They've already surrendered in their mind. They're already Canadians with some sort of heritage that comes from ancestors that used to be Native. they don't really believe in a living existence as an indigenous person. And this is fairly recent. Up until 50, 60 years ago, our people fought for the continuing existence of a separate nation in relationship to Canada. And a few years ago, all of a sudden our leaders, our thinkers, our professors, our writers start talking about an indigenous existence within Canada. To me, this is a betrayal. We have to live in relationship to Canada. Of course we have. But the idea that you can be both a Canadian person in the fullest extent of the word, a citizen of Canada, and a Nuhal person or a Mohawk person that is fully honoring your responsibilities to your ancestors, that doesn't make any sense. Our ancestors were not Canadians. Our ancestors were Nuhal and Mohawk. So we have to figure out a way to respect our ancestors and to reconcile with our ancestors, never mind reconciling with the people who came here and stole our land. Why is reconciliation about us finding a place within the criminal regime that stole everything that our ancestors valued? We should stand up and look our ancestors, so to speak, in the eye and say, how can I reconcile with you? How can I have respect in my ancestors' eyes in the way that I live in my land? Never mind getting a white man to pat us on the back and tell us that everything's going to be okay and they're going to stop brutalizing us if we just play along with their fantasy of colonialism. But unfortunately, that's what most of our leaders are doing. I don't mean leaders at the community level. I mean people who are active in politics and setting the agenda on the national and provincial levels. But this is a defeatist attitude, and I think that our ancestors would be really ashamed of the way our politics have descended into surrender, aka reconciliation.
Wow. And part of what I'm hearing in a way is that we can't really trust their intentions. To me and from my perceptions, I see strategy behind the scenes and tactics that are fully intentional. And I want to touch on a phrase that you used in your essay, the psychological war on our young people. And I'm going to share a clip here from your essay with our listeners, and I'll ask you a little bit about it.
If reconciliation is allowed to reign, our young people are going to bear the brunt of this recolonization and carry a tension inside of them that is very difficult, if not impossible, to live with. Indeed, we are already seeing the sickening results of this psychological war on our young people in the shocking and recurring waves of self-harm and suicide that afflict every one of our communities.
So my interpretation on that would be that the psychological effects on our people are not merely byproducts, but perhaps calculated and intentional results. Your thoughts?
I agree with you, brother. That's psychological war is absolutely essential to maintaining us in this position of dependency and subservience to the Canadian state and to white society. Problem is made double for young people because they haven't yet learned how to rationalize that. Young people expect people to tell the truth. Young people expect authenticity. Young people react very, very strongly to fakery and lies. And when they find out that their leaders are selling them lies in order to just maintain a level of comfort, the reaction psychologically is profound. People lose hope. People get discouraged. People become despondent. And that's a serious issue as it relates to the problems that I identified in that phrase there in all of our communities. What's called alienation is compounded in our people. So people are alienated within this whole system that the white people have brought here, capitalism. It's alienating. It's, you know, you need material things. You need fancy things. You need entertainment. You need drugs and alcohol and all that just to maintain yourself within this system because it's not real. It doesn't give you a real satisfaction in life. And then you find out that the alternative that we're supposed to be fighting for in our communities, an indigenous way of life, indigenous rights, all this stuff, you find out that that's been watered down in order to be accepted by the white people who run this country. Where's the hope? Where's the hope for young people to realize themselves as honorable in the eyes of sisters or true natives or just to feel good about themselves as native people in their own homeland, knowing their responsibilities as young indigenous people? Where can they live that out? And where are the pathways to channel that kind of energy when everything is geared towards making the white people smile? And where are we when they're all smiling and still holding on to all of our money and all of our land? We're left with hardly anything. Some of us make it, you know, some of us do well, but the bulk of indigenous people, where do they stand in this reconciliation? White people get to feel less guilty. Native leaders get to get rewarded for being a good Indian. And our young people are suffering physically and mentally, and suicide continues to rise. And people don't want to admit the reason for that is because young people don't have purpose as indigenous. And they see through the lies. They see the bullshit, excuse me, that's there. And that's what we need to address, and that's what I was pointing to in that phrase.
Right on. Wow. And I just want to share with you that our people here, our young minds and our old minds all alike, we have a really strong sense of nationhood and sovereignty. And with that in mind, I just want to reshape a little bit some of what I've heard in your essay about the importance of transferring land back to us. But we here in our Nukhalk territory, we might say that we are a unique and distinct people, and we have never relinquished anything. We have been here since we were placed here. We were never migrated, and it might not so much then be about transferring land back to us as it would be simply respecting our rights as human beings, as the indigenous people of this area with the lawful jurisdiction and authority here. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's right on. I mean, I think if people carried that attitude like your people do into the engagements they have with the government over all of these problems that we're facing when it comes to land and when it comes to governance, when it comes to addressing the crimes that have been committed against our people, they carried that spirit with them. And if we all work together to bring that spirit to the government en masse, things would be a lot different and things would change. But as it stands, as I've been talking about here, too much of that spirit has been watered down by the spirit of reconciliation. And so it's one of the reasons why I always connected with people there in the time that I spent there is because I recognized and was fortunate enough to make friends and connections over there with people who I understand are still carrying on that idea of what it is to be native, as opposed to the ones that have been put upon us in order to distract us from what our real mission is as Native people in 2020, which is to stay connected to and to fight hard for the ancestral vision that you're articulating.
I see it's part of our role here as Nukhalk people with our perspective of the world as being one of the last places to be colonized across Turtle Island here, we in a way are still closely attached, more so than others across Turtle Island, and it's up to us to stand up and push back and create a wave of love and hope and collaboration back towards the East. Colonization has come to the West and it has to end here. And we're going to push back and send our love and our thoughts and our ways of life or how we approach the world back towards the East. And any help that we can get along the way would benefit not just us here, but our entire planet.
Beautifully said. And I totally agree with you on how important it is for those of us who see things this way and who believe in the teachings of our ancestors and who are committed to take action on that, to stand in solidarity together. And I don't speak for anyone but myself right now, but I know that there's a lot of people who believe in this. And I know that we need to find a way to organize that, to counter all of the assimilation and all of the co-optive and all of the reconciliatory movements and agendas and energies that's out there. And I think if we think back even just a couple of months ago, well, a few months ago in February and over the winter, when we had people in Wet'suwet'en territory standing for their nationhood and their rights and their land and the water there, you saw how people all over the land, and especially in my own nation, in the Mohawk Nation, stood with them. And I think it really bodes well for anybody in the West who wants to make that last stand against colonialism and make it the last place that it does its dirty work and pushes back and cleanses the land of that colonialism. There's people in the East who will stand with them in solidarity. I know that for a fact.
Right on, right on. We are covering quite a bit of ground here. Lots of in-depth emotions and discussions, I'm sure, coming to life out there with our listeners. And I think we should let our listeners have a bit of a, what I call a brain break, let them absorb and think about things for a little bit. And as we move into that, I have a song lined up. But first off, I'd like to ask you to do what we call a station ID. We have on Tuesdays, Dayaki Tuesday, where we replay many of your speeches, your presentations, and I'll share with you now a couple here to let you know what they sound like. Sorry, just trying to find the right button. All right, here we go. Here's one from Stan Bevan.
Yeah, this is Stan Bevan. You're listening to New Hulk Radio, broadcasting from sovereign New Hulk territory.
This is Arthur Manuel. You are listening to 91.1 New Hulk Radio, broadcasting from sovereign New Hulk territory.
So if you're able to share with us a station ID, that would be great, and then we can take a short little break with some music.
I'll do my best to follow in those giant footsteps. There you go. This is Tayaige Alfred, and you're listening to New Hulk Radio, coming to you from sovereign New Hulk territory.
Beautiful, beautiful. Why? Stutwini Klappenu Sanam Napolf New Hulk Radio, Insta Koch, Ashkolegistominitsdo. Chatting here with Dayaki Alfred. We'll be right back with some more discussion and talk about so many things important to all of us here in New Hulk territory and around the world. Why?
Unsurrendered.
Canada can only exist where a treaty exists.
Untreaties.
Within those boundaries of that agreed on treaty.
Sovereign New Hulk territory.
So why do we still follow the Canadian Act and the Canadian law if we're not treaty?
New Hulk Radio.
That's a good question.
Untreaties.
There's no treaty here.
Unsurrendered.
So there's no Canada
because
here.
Because we're not treaty, then we can totally enforce our laws on our land.
Sovereign.
Today.
91.1 FM New Hulk Radio.
Why? Stutunidu Shlapanu Sainam Napolf New Hulk Radio Insta Quach. And we are speaking here today with Dayaki Alfred. Such an honor and a privilege to be sharing space time with such a man. And we are going to step out of the book a little bit here now, and I have some general questions for Dayaki. I have a lot of respect for his perspective and experience, and so I'll be chatting with him a little bit about a few other things. But first off, Dayaki, how is it going there? How are you feeling with how things are going here?
Oh, just thanks again for doing this. I'm loving it, and it's really, you know, the kind of conversation we're having is really lighting me up, you know. Like in the break, I was saying, can you feel the emotion coming through me over all this distance? And, you know, it's really, really an honor. And I thank you for giving me the chance to talk about all this with you.
All right. So I have some little more specific questions relating kind of in a way to us Nukhalk here and our perceptions of the world. And from my understanding, there are two basic circumstances across Turtle Island, areas where historic treaties have been signed and places like here where there is no treaty. Can you touch on some of the similarities and differences of these two circumstances?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the similarity is one that people shouldn't forget, is that there are Native people who had civilization and law and culture and whose homeland the whole of Canada is. And so whether there's a historic treaty or a modern treaty or no treaty at all, the whole of Canada is the homeland to Native nations. And when we distinguish it in law and politics today, it's often made, the distinction is often made between historic treaties, number treaties, modern treaties, and none. So there's like four categories. So the pre-Confederation treaties were ones where generally it's seen in law and the way that it's put into practice in negotiations, in that Native nations were negotiated with on the basis of them being sovereign. So it was the French crown or the British crown negotiating with nations that they had to deal with in law equal to them. So whether you were in a military struggle or a political struggle or economic relationship, those nation-to-nation treaties are basically the founding of Canada. You know, that's why Native people were strong and adamant on the idea of nationhood, because those treaties were the things that allowed European people to come and settle in this territory and build the societies that they did, and to which everyone who's here, whether they're European or not in origin, owe their existence on this land. So the treaties with the Mi'kmaq and the Maliseet and the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe and people in that era of the early contact period were treated as nations. And so that's one way of thinking of what a treaty is. And then once Canada was formed itself as a country, they started to make treaties with all the nations west of the Great Lakes, all the way up to the Rocky Mountains. This is approximate. You know, there's some exceptions there, but from the Great Lakes all the way to Rocky Mountains, south of the Arctic Circle, subarctic. And you had all these number treaties, which were Canada's attempt to kind of bring all of the nations that existed in those territories into the framework of the law. Because previous to that, they too are sovereign people. And Canada wants to engage them and bring them into some sort of legal relationship. The problem is the interpretation of those, just like in our interpretation, those that had pre-Confederation treaties, these are not surrenders. These are not documents that say, we were here, you came here, you say you're better than us, therefore you can have a title to all our land and tell us what to do. I mean, that's what white people say treaties are. But there's none of our ancestors that believe that, and nobody in law who actually looks at history and the interactions that went into the formation of those treaties believes that. But because of the effects of diseases on people and reduction of our population and the increase in numbers of white people and the militarization of that society and the use of force and violence, they were able to put that mistaken, self-serving and illegal interpretation on treaties in our territory. And then they brought that to the Great Lakes and they brought that to the prairies. They weren't able to bring that to your territory and to the far north because it took a lot longer to settle it and it took a lot longer for them to develop the ability to force their illegal and self-serving and fraudulent interpretation of what a treaty is upon our people. People were able to resist simply because of the geography. They were able to resist because of, in some cases, economic relations they have that were mutually beneficial, and also because the state itself, meaning Canada and the government and the military and all of the apparatus that go into enforcing white people supremacy in this land, it wasn't fully developed yet in that territory. Once it was, they started to do the same thing they did in the east and on the prairies. Now they tried to do it in British Columbia, in the Yukon, and in the north. And so we have quite late in the game, so to speak, of treaty making, this whole treaty process in British Columbia coming up in the 90s, where they're trying to foist this idea of the subservience of Indigenous nations to white power and white government. And they're trying to do it through law. They're trying to do it through economics, meaning offering incentives, paying off Native leaders, buying people's votes, all kinds of things like that. But make no mistake about it, all the people listening there, if people don't sign a treaty, or if they at least don't go along with what the intent of the treaty is, which is to get at all your trees, all your fish, all your minerals, everything, to get at all of that and use it to benefit themselves and not you, they will use violence. So the commonality is there. The difference is, what sneaky way is the white man going to use to get their way? So they always govern by fraud, lies, and abuse. It's just that they could get away with doing it differently in the 1700s and the 1800s and the early 1900s than they can now. Now they have to be a lot more sneaky. And so the only difference in treaty making is in the method that the government's using in order to advance its objective of stealing everything from us. And there's always been another commonality, is there's always been people within our nations who cooperate in a selfish way, who set themselves up as the ones who are in between the objective of white power and supremacy and our ancestral power. And before, it used to be easy to identify them. Unfortunately, now there's hundreds of people who have been convinced that the agenda of the government is the thing that needs to win the day and not the agenda of our ancestors. And so the battle is much more cultural, political, and legal, as opposed to physical, because our people are not standing together unified to push back against white power. That's what people in the East did in the first instance. That's why they used military force. Here they're trying to use much more subtle means in order to get their way. But let's not make any mistake. Their goal is the same as it always has been.
Well, there was an important point in there that you mentioned that didn't really occur to me till much later in my experience, and that is that those people who have those ancient, not really ancient, but historic pre-Confederation treaties, they never ceded their territory. If anything, these treaties strengthened their sovereignty in a way. And now I'm curious if there are any examples, or if it's something that some people might be willing to consider, is canceling those treaties with Canada because the other party has breached that treaty. Is that something that can be considered, and how might that play out?
Yeah, I mean, it comes up, that point comes up rhetorically a lot. People are like, well, if they're not upholding their bargain in the treaty that was made, that makes the benefits that they got from the treaty null and void, which logically makes sense. But the facts on the ground, of course, are much more complicated and difficult. the fact is that they've gained the benefit over hundreds of years now, in some cases in my territory, from these treaty relationships. And they've used those benefits to strengthen themselves numerically, militarily, economically. And in this process, many of our nations have sunken into dependency. We've lost the ability to feed ourselves. We've lost the ability for independent action. And we've lost the ability to have organized resistance to the kind of discipline that white society would push on us if we were to disobey and go against the treaty. And so it's difficult. So when we're talking about the treaty being null and void, personally, from all of my study as a professional historian and scholar, and just from my own experience being both a treaty negotiator, a land claim negotiator for like 30 years now, I don't know one instance where a white man has kept his word. There's not a single treaty that's been honored. There's not a single promise that's been kept. Even the words coming out of the minister's mouth today are likely to be a lie. Now, what's a treaty worth in that context? That's what your people need to think about.
Well, I think you would be happy to know that here in Nuchalk, treaty is actually a four-letter word. And we have continued our ancestral government and its healing and its relearning. But we also have the Indian Act elections. But we here in Nuchalk, we seem to be in a fairly unique situation where our ancestral leadership and our elected leadership are working together with our elected leaders supporting our ancestral government. What are your thoughts on this and perhaps any cautions you might have for us moving forward?
Well, I raise my hands up to your community for that. You know, one of the things that you have to look at is the reality that we've inherited. Where do we stand today? Where we stand today is that colonialism has made its inroads into our community. It is a present reality. And we have to think about what our responsibilities are to our ancestral vision and our nationhood from where we are today in a realistic sense of the word. And we do have the Bank Council, and the decisions that were made in order to accept the Bank Council and rationalize that and take those institutions into our communities were made by our ancestors for what I imagine were very good reasons. They were Ongwehunwe people. They understood the realities at the time. They understood probably what they needed to do in order to survive. And so these institutions were pressed on us in a way where our ancestors had to make a very pragmatic calculation, probably along the lines of starve or accept the Bank Council. Watch your kids die or take some assistance from the Canadian government, because they will let your kids die if you don't accept this form of government that they're telling us we need to accept. And there's proven cases where that's happened. And so I'm not here, and in none of my writings and thinking and in my mind, it's not a matter of going back and questioning the judgment of our ancestors from like 1901 or 1910 or something like that. It's just getting serious about where we're at. And for me, I work in this context too. I work in Kahnawake in my own community. I'm involved in a project of strengthening our governance and rethinking what governance means going forward for the whole of the community and helping our people think through that. And we're doing the same thing. Trying to find a way to think through the idea of where does this institution that was created out of colonialism evolve to? Does it need to stay colonial? Does it need to be something that reflects the agenda of the Canadian government, or can it evolve to be responsible and integral and useful, most to the point, useful part of a resurgent nationhood and traditional governing system in the community? The answer that you've given me is great to hear, and that you're exploring ways to work together. I think that's a start. And over the winter with the solidarity blockades and the conflicts that it brought about with the outside people, our people came together and worked together almost for the first time in many years politically, and we stood together to support the young, mostly women, who were doing the solidarity blockades, and people from the bank council, people from our localized peacekeepers or police, people from the Warrior Society, people from the longhouses. We all worked together to support what was a common cause. That was something that brought a lot of people satisfaction, joy, and hope for the future, because it showed that we can move on from this colonially imposed reality, which is not only the bank council, but the tensions around the bank council and its legitimacy, to try to find a way where we can step by step move away from Canadian government having the overriding influence on what happens in our community, and take that back and make it our own people, recognizing as well the pragmatics of the situation, in that we do live in a situation of dependency for the most part in many Indigenous communities. And so how do we imagine this journey away from the band council as it was intended to be, to a form of governance where the traditional system, the ideas of traditional governments, chiefs and clan mothers, that way of governing is the authority to which whatever bureaucratic structure or administrative mechanism that you have in the community, also known as the band council, works for, to facilitate things that happen for the betterment of the community. And so I don't have the answer to that, and I don't hear you saying that you have the ultimate answer, but communities that acknowledge that, first of all, the legitimate government of our nation is the traditional government, and acknowledge the necessity of a process to restore that, and then put the work into thinking through everything that's in place now to make that happen, and doing it in a way that acknowledges the history and the culture, and all, and most importantly, the necessity to restore our nationhood for future generations, cultural survival as Umwahumwe people, as Umwahumwe. That's something good. And I think that those communities that are doing that are on the leading edge of what it means to decolonize in Canada today. Our community has a standing resolution. This is the band council has a standing resolution from 1979, which says exactly what I'm talking about, that traditional government in Kahnawake will be restored. And there's a mandate of the band council to facilitate and make that happen. And everything we're doing now is a commitment to that. So it's good to hear that that's also happening in your nation.
Yeah, our ancestors and our people, they had to spend lots of time thinking and considering things. They were presented with a couple of options, one big reserve or a bunch of smaller reserves scattered around through our lands. And they met for a long time and discussed and debated, and they together set their mind as one and decided on a bunch of smaller so-called reserves scattered throughout our territory, knowing that would at least give us that little sliver of us to grab onto and return ourselves to the land out there. And we living now, we are ancestors of tomorrow, and our actions that we take now will have consequences that we as human beings are unable to fully comprehend. And we here as a people, we need our resources out in our territory. We collectively have not consented to the commercial extraction of any of our resources. For example, Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans continues to authorize commercial fisheries, even though we have informed them that we have not and do not consent to commercial extraction of our salmon, but they don't listen. What can we do here now as ancestors of the future to address these everyday realities? Might there be international approaches that we can consider as a people to persuade Canada and its DFO to respect our human rights and to listen?
I don't believe in politics following the law. Kind of reinforcing a position that I took and an analysis that I bring to this that I mentioned earlier, in that we've been convinced that legal strategies are the thing that's going to free us from colonialism, when in fact all the evidence is that assertion of rights, direct action, confrontation, political and physical, is the only thing that generates the political will on the part of the Canadian government to want to resolve a problem. And then the law follows. And so treaties are negotiated, agreements are negotiated, and so forth. Arrangements are made, so to speak. But I think people get it backwards these days. And there's a lot of sort of built-in momentum to the idea of following a legal strategy to get recognition of rights, which can then be exercised. And I think there's a logic to that that's built into our politics today, which hasn't really been borne out by any evidence on the ground. There's a lot of momentum due to the fact that the government funds these processes. There's a lot of momentum due to the fact that a lot of people profit from it. And there's a lot of momentum because it siphons energy away from potentially transformative situations on the ground that would come up as a result of direct assertion of rights. And I think that as a scholar and as a person who's been involved for decades now, there's no getting around the fact that change only comes when you assert yourself and create an environment where the government is willing to come and, or not willing, feels it has to come to the table to renegotiate a relationship or to respect your rights.
Right on. So as Nukhalk people, we keep doing what we're doing in a way where we are leading the way, we are breaking new ground in ways. And looking forward in space-time, I do my best to perceive as many plausible realities from the most dire to the most optimistic. What might be your most optimistic reality that you can see moving forward from where we are here today?
My most optimistic reality moving forward in terms of an Indigenous movement is for Generation Z, like we're seeing in the United States, refuse to take it anymore and to begin to assert a new reality and to challenge all of the people who are defending the old reality in very assertive ways, both legally and politically and culturally and in the streets if necessary. Not so much in the streets for our people, but on the territory, on the land. So much more of a direct assertion and a unified movement, not unified in terms of merging our identities, of course, but unified in terms of solidarity, where we get away from the whole rabbit hole of identity politics that's taken up so much of our time and energy, and focus again on working together to assert our nationhood on the land and supporting each other like we saw this winter. You saw what solidarity actions across the country did to the Canadian government and the Canadian economy. It caused a national crisis, which they were willing to come to the table and to address. When's the last time that happened, when you try to go to court or you try to argue at a negotiating table for Canadians to feel bad about what they've done or to want to address anything in a substantial way? look at all the things that have happened and the crimes that were committed, residential school and day school and disparities in funding for children in school and healthcare and child apprehensions and all that. What has the Canadian government done other than pay people off? They haven't made any substantial changes in the way power is structured. They haven't made any kind of substantial changes in the systemic nature of racism. They haven't looked at our ability to live out our culture on our land and made more space for that and respected our ancestral responsibilities. They only do things like that when people fight back and people make it impossible for them to carry on the way that they have been carrying on. And I think that that's something that we really need to recognize, and we need a nationwide movement to support that type of direct action against the status quo. And to me, I'm very optimistic that the younger generation, who is hardly invested economically in the system that's been set up in place, can really move to organize themselves to challenge all that, to challenge not only the obvious colonialism of white people having stole our land and refusing to give it back and profiting off it, but also the institutions that have been set up and who are run by our own people to prevent us from rising up against it. And to challenge everybody who's clouding the matter with arguments that mean nothing in the context of a land base that's shrinking and governments and cultures which are fading away because of our lack of energy in maintaining them. So to me, that sounds like negative at the end, but I'm pretty optimistic that this younger generation can rise up and make change the way that people are making change in the U.S. by fighting. That's my optimistic scenario. It's certainly what I'm changing. It's certainly what I'm training my 12-year-old son to do. I don't know about other people, but that's what my hope is for him.
Right on. We have quite the future ahead of us, and our young minds, they are so powerful. We here in our Nuchalk territory, we have our youth with strong sovereignty in their minds. They are Nuchalkim. I asked a young person once about his identity, if he was British Columbian. He thought for a moment and he giggled, "No, I'm Nuchalkim." And with that combined with what I think could be really just starting to come to light all across Turtle Island and around the world, our guests or settlers, for lack of a better word, that fully honor and respect our history as a people, our laws, our government, our ways, and they are looking to support us here in our Nuchalk Valley and all across Turtle Island, and together with everyone, from those just born to the Butchalt, those yet to be born, it will come down to what we call Smaudi Silk Ich, one heart. One heart, one mind. Everyone together, not just Indigenous, not just Nuchalk, but the world eventually.
Beautifully said, brother.
Well, I'm sure we could talk for hours and hours and hours here, and I really enjoyed our time here together, but we've covered a lot, and I think we should be wrapping up here shortly. So if there's anything, final messages, anything you'd like to share before we sign out from our talk here today?
Oh, I just want to say thank you again, Yao Goa, for allowing me to have the time and giving me the space and the place to speak to these issues. And again, it's a great honor. And I'm looking forward to the day to be able to travel back to your territory and to stand up in front of a whole bunch of young warriors and do this in person. Yao.
Right on. We look forward to that day. I have a lot of respect for you. I view you as a mentor in a way. I do my best to surround myself with those that I can learn from and you have blazed a good path for us that have coming behind you, and me, myself, in turn, am doing my best to clear a good path for those yet to come. So thank you very much again for your time here today. It is most, most honored and appreciated.
Now it's gonna go.
Why, that there was Dayaki Alfred here on Nuchalk Radio. Instaquach, Stutuniru, Chapanustein, Napolsh Nuchalk Radio, broadcasting from sovereign Nuchalk territory. Shusham Kdush, Salats Kdaliwash, Ashtis Kutulam Hishtaich, and Wasuludi Chats, broadcasting the laws of the lands and waters. Why?